Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session.
Welcome back to Fright School. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Joshua.
Oh my gosh, look at us. Deep into November. That's what we're dubbing this time. November. New movies.
Yes.
Although, not. I mean, it's kind of a mixed bag on today's episode because we're going to talk about we're really talking mostly about the original Hellraiser, but to celebrate.
Way to walk that back.
The reboot of Hellraiser. But we'll get to all of that. How art thou?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Excellent.
How art thou?
I'm all right. I meant to talk about this on the last episode, and I forgot, but you know, I don't know. Like, is COVID just, like, clouding all of our brains, and we thought maybe that the world was slightly a better place before COVID?
Oh, sis, where are you going?
I feel like the last couple of years, people have, like, totally forgotten how to be humans in public. Like, it just seems like everywhere I go, people are just, like, becoming more and more. And there's lots of reasons for that, lots of sociopolitical reasons as well.
You are older now.
Right, I'm also just older, and I'm just, like, becoming more and more of a curmudgeon. But no, I really feel like people just don't know how to act in public anymore. Like, I feel like everywhere you go, like, people are just, like, acting like jerks for no reasons, where it's just like, oh my gosh, take a deep breath, calm down.
What happened? What brought these thoughts on?
Well, so we went to see, now a couple of weeks ago, Oingo Boingo, the former members of Oingo Boingo. Danny Elfman obviously is doing his own thing, and was at the Hollywood Bowl that night, you know, playing to, you know, thousands of people the music that he's known for, like all of the film soundtracks. And although I do think he was playing some Oingo Boingo material. Anyways. Point is, we went out there and we did this last year as well, which is kind of where this first started, where I was, you know, thinking about, like, I mean, I know some bands just fans suck. Like, there's no way around it. Some bands just have people that come that are just assholes in a way, or again, they're main characters, the main characters in the world, and nobody can tell them otherwise. But
I really like how you put that.
But they just... Yeah, so, like, last year was kind of a bit of a hellacious experience. Just people were being kind of real douchebags and drinking a lot and just being, you know, jerks. But I felt like we were still, like, able to kind of enjoy the show for the most part. Last night, or not last night, but, well, whatever. At the Oingo Boingo show, when we were there, it was, like, a million times worse than it's ever been. Like, people were fighting. This whole fight broke out between us. People, like, punching each other. And, like, security got involved and ended up letting everybody stay. And I usually just, I'm like, I'm not going to get involved in this. But the people that had come up, first of all, we had gotten there early and kind of got our spot on the what's called the wall at Humphreys by the Bay here in San Diego, which I've talked about before.
It's your usual spot.
Yeah, it's like the usual spot. We get there really early before doors open because, you know, in order to get a spot on the wall. So you don't have to sit in the uncomfortable seats. So we got there really early and we were hanging out. We were like having a good time and we were like chatting with other people and like everything was good. And like this group of guys comes up and they're all queer from what I gathered from their conversation. And they were visiting from like Fresno or somewhere. Come down. They were already wasted, talking very loudly. And it was funny because we had kind of been, we were at like our area and one of them came and like sat down like almost behind me, like where I was standing, where, and I had like my fan and like my stuff. And I'm like, no, like I'm already sitting there, person. First of all, like this is where we're at, you know, but we accommodate, we moved up a little bit, which caused a little bit of crowding with the people that were already in front of us, but it was fine, you know? Anyways, so we were like sat back down, just listened to like the bumper music and stuff. And, you know, they're just like being like talking at the top of their lungs. They're all slurring already. And this is like 7 o'clock. Like the show hasn't even started and they're already wasted.
Damn.
Talking so loudly and just being generally being jerks. So then the first band started. They talked through the whole thing, screaming at the top of their lungs at each other for Dramarama, which I wanted to hear because they're really fun. You know, like not a hugely popular band, but well, I mean, I guess not to me. I don't know. Maybe they are. Anyways, not the point. People were not there just to see them. They were there
to see Oingo Boingo, yeah.
And these people definitely were there to see Oingo Boingo. They didn't care about anybody else who was playing, and they didn't care about any of the rest of us who wanted to hear them play.
Yeah.
So that band ended.
Which is like, why show up early then if you're going to don't even want to see the opener?
Yeah. And they had already shoved their way in front of a couple that was also on the wall right behind us. So I don't even know how that happened. It's like they must have pushed them out of the way. They just kind of took over the space. So we had them over here. We
colonizers.
We had a whole collection of old white dudes, which a lot of Oingo Boingo fans kind of are. They look like the Sam Squanch, and that's fine. No judgment against them, except these guys were douchebags. They kept hitting on the waitresses and like talking to the women around, like in really kind of lascivious ways. And I just kept kind of like, can you all shut the fuck up? You know, like, and then they were also talking about their wives and, you know, how they're taking a break from the wives for the night and they're all going on a cruise together. And they were just being generally gross. So we had those gross heads there and these assholes next to us. And then the one turns to me. He's like, could you scoot down a little? I'm like, no, because you've already pushed us as far as we can go. Yeah, no. So I didn't move. And then I would not yield space the whole night. I like put up a wall. I was like, boundary, like, sorry. You know, you can go somewhere else. You can go back to your real seat, maybe. That'd be really great. Anyways, but that was before the fight broke out. And I tried to tell security because they kept bringing them drinks. And, like, I actually gave the waitress, like, I was like, girl, no more alcohol for these people. They're wasted. And the one fell over by the end of the night. Almost rolled off into fucking the bay. They had to come, like, drag him out because he was so drunk. He was the one that got into the fight.
Overserved much?
Way overserved. All of them. And I also heard that they were on psilocybin, some of them. And there was a woman in the audience who also had brought chocolate with her with magic mushrooms in it, which, again, I have no problem. Like, that's wonderful if you can control yourself. And these people could not. So it just got more and more and more out of control. And the guy behind them finally had enough. And I get it because, like, I was at that point because they kept, like, elbowing and pushing and, like, talking, screaming loud because this then Missing Persons, another band. You know their song probably, Walking in L.A. You ever heard that song? Walking in L.A. Or What Are Words For? No? None of this?
No.
Okay. Anyways, the 80s is back, y'all.
You must be confusing me with someone else.
Well, these are popular 80s songs. They show up on 80s things. You know, Destination Unknown. No. Anyways, not the point.
You must be confusing me with someone else.
Yeah. Well, these are dancey pop hits.
I was born in 1989.
You like a pop tune. I wasn't around when these were new.
Joshua, you haven't shown it to me yet. That's why I do not know that.
Well, whatever.
That it's here.
Anyways, the point is all during Missing Persons, when they weren't screaming the songs they knew at the top of their drunken lungs, then they were talking and pushing and trying to take selfies. And I mean, the guy, he was like leaning into me, like pushing me over so he could like take pictures. And I'm just like, of the people behind him, I was just like, oh my gosh, enough. And the guy finally got enough, I guess, of them pushing and hitting and like screaming. And he like got into like a pushing match with the guy. And then he was a big dude. And this guy was a smaller dude. And he like,
this is one of the queers.
Yeah, the it was a straight couple,
uh-huh,
and the man got fed up with them.
Got it.
So he grabbed the one by the neck, the back of the neck, like a kitten or something.
Oh, shit.
And like had him up, and he was just like, you're going to fucking stop. Do it. You know, so they had a whole fight, and then security got involved, and I
let them stay.
Let them all stay in the same spot where they continued to like fight the whole night, like the rest of the evening, like just being assholes with each other. And I tried to tell security because I was like, I just saw the whole thing, and these people are all wasted. Like, they are drunk, and they've been jerks all night, pushing, shoving, whatever. And security was just like, it's Humphreys, you know? They're very like, everybody just chill. That's what they told. They're like, everybody just relax and just enjoy the show. Just look at the show. Just watch the show.
Yeah.
So, and then they left them to their
own. We don't want to give you your money back. We don't want to have that awkward conversation. We are avoidant about that. Yeah.
But anyway, so the rest of the night, they were just jerks. And again, it was like the whole audience. And this is like, it keeps happening. When I went to the Jesse Ware concert, same thing. I tried to be really nice to somebody and let him stand in front of me. He was really short. He's a really tiny dude. And I guess I'm not going to do that no more. Like,
what did he do?
Like, I let him stand in front of me. And then the whole night, he kept like swinging his hands back and like screaming, and he hit me in the face several times. And finally I kind of had enough of it, and because he was with this guy who was not his boyfriend, they were like exes or whatever, but they were all over each other. It was very,
ew.
Did I talk about, I don't know, it was very confusing.
Hold on, go back to that. So what was going on here? The messiness of this man, this little man who, mm-hmm, apparently like was with his ex and they were fondling each other, but it wasn't his boyfriend.
No, but I just mean they were like dancing together. It looked like they were boyfriends, but they kept insisting they were exes. And I don't care. I mean, that's not really the point of the story. True. But the guy, he was just like, this was near the end of the show. And like I said, the guy, he kept hitting and pushing and talking and leaving and coming back and leaving and coming back and leaving and coming back and leaving and coming back.
Did you have assigned seats?
No, it was it's GA.
Oh, okay.
But I got there like I always do early because I wanted to be like close to the stage. But I felt bad because we had been talking to people and like they all seemed nice and cool. So I was like, you know, I was like, I'm sorry, I'm really tall. I'm wearing this black sequin sparkly jacket. You know, like I kind of went all out for this 70s kind of vibe of the show of the Jesse Ware, you know, What's Your Pleasure album.
Sure,
it's very 70s. And so I was like, you know, I'll let him stand in front of me. And then, yeah, just all night he was just jumping up and down and screaming. And just he was so rude. And like the guy that he was with kept apologizing and thanking me. Like, I really appreciate that you let us come up and stand in front of you and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, it's fine. It's fine. Fine. But again, like he kept hitting me in the face and doing other stuff and not even apologizing. Like not even because he was also getting progressively more and more drunk. That's the other big factor in all of these cases. You know, and so finally, like, I was just kind of, like, really fucking annoyed. And the guy was, like, asked him, he's like, you know, oh, are you having a good time? He's like, yeah. It's like, oh, yeah, he's having a great time to the exclusion of all others. And this kid, because he really was, like, in his 20s, like, turned on me and was, like, getting upset with me. And I'm like, you keep hitting me in the face. So you're going to stop that, you know? So he did. He moved like way over away from me. But he was like a total asshole the rest of the night to me, which I don't care. Like, good. Get out of my space, you know? But he like acted like I had done something wrong when like he kept hitting me, you know? And I would like kind of tap him, you know, on, you know, like, oh, you know, like just move up a little, you know, or whatever. Because he had plenty of space. That was the other thing. He was taking up a lot of space because he was hitting everybody around him, you know? So it was just a big mistake. And I'm like, this is why I'm not nice to people. Fuck you. Get here early. You know, so anyway, so it's that thing. It just keeps happening. We keep going to shows and it's like people have really, truly just forgotten how to like act in public and they are just kind of getting worse and worse. It's just like, I mean, it was so ugly. And this, like Jesse Ware is not that kind of show. This was not like fucking the Pit at the Iron Maiden concert where people were running around and punching each other. That's the Pit, you know, like I get it. Like this wasn't that. And like Oingo Boingo is also not that kind of, like they're a ska band for Christ's sake. You know, I don't know. Maybe I don't know enough about ska. Maybe this is the culture of it.
Matt Kelly, please. Matt Kelly, please. When you hear this, message Joshua immediately.
He's going to say, yeah, ska people are always wasted assholes. No,
anyone.
I don't know.
Anyone.
I don't really, like, I really do try to have, like, a good time. Like, I'm just like, let's all, like, be chill. You know, like,
this is why I don't do concerts. This is why I hear these stories and I'm like, I need an assigned seat. I need this is the time that the show starts. This is the time when the show is going to end.
Right.
Or the approximate time it's going to end. I need an aside. I cannot do this. This is nonsense. I cannot put up with.
It's just getting worse and worse. I feel like every time we go to a show, it's just like, oh man, it's just, why are people, it's like, why can't you just go to the show and enjoy the show? Like we're here watching the show, like watch the show. Yeah. It just makes no sense. So yeah, these people were just really messy and really rude the whole time. And as the night progressed, more people got rude. Finally, this guy, I don't know what he like grabbed his girlfriend, somebody totally out or wife, whatever, this woman he was with, and just barreled through like the whole audience and like shoved up next to like Jeffrey and I. And we were like, what the fuck? Like, so finally I told Jeffrey they finished the song and I was like, I'm done with this merry band of assholes, to quote that again, which I did actually say, I'm getting out of here. So I went way to the back of the venue and like cooled off and like, you know, I was talking to some of like the security people because everybody looked harried, like because it was all over the place. Like just it was like, again, I guess Michael Myers showed up and infected everybody with evil.
Yes.
Because they were all fucking assholes. Like everywhere you turned, it was just people main charactering. Yeah. I'm the only person in this whole place. This band came just for me. And I will talk over them if I want. God damn it. So
that's,
yeah,
that's the social media world that we're living in, though. It's like, you know, you have a platform where you get to people have their own presence where it's like they get to be the main character of their life. And so, you know, it's natural that kind of crosses over. It's the same thing where, you know, people who talk at the theater, right? Like it's what television did to like people going to like the theater, and television and movies did, where it's like, you can't, this is not your home where you're existing with other
others
people.
Can hear you.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, 100%. It's nuts. It's just like, what is going on? So, and I really do feel it's getting worse. You know, we've talked for years on this show. We go to a lot of shows. We go to lots of concerts. We love live music. I don't want that to end, but it's like everywhere you go, it's like, so I told Jeffrey, I was like, is it our karma? Like, did we do something, you know, in a past life? Like, what's happened? Is life just too kind to me? It's filled with lovely, wonderful people. My life is like so content that when I go to I'm like an asshole magnet. People are just like, let's fuck up that guy's day. Let's go over there. It's like we're just attracting it.
Well, you know, I mean, it sounds like these people just don't know. Like, my thing is, like, if you need those things to have a good time, you should really interrogate that.
Right.
You should investigate, do a little deeper work, as it were. It's like, you know, you, psilocybin, you know, magic mushrooms, all of that shit at a show, you know, you go to a rave and you have, like, you know, all this stuff. But that's the thing is that, like, I almost, like, to me, going to a rave would sound more preferential to doing that because
you expect it.
Well, not only do I expect it, but
it's
like
a different,
the culture of it is this very plur piece, you know, all of this, like everything is, everyone is having a good time and we are all there to share this experience. And then you have like, you know, we have to look at music that is beloved by cis white people and really start to be like, why do they like it? And then not be surprised when those people show up. It's like when I went to the fucking, I went to a Bill Burr.
Oh, the comedy thing.
Well, went to the Bill Burr comedy thing in Vegas, with my ex years ago. And it's like, you know, he loves Bill Burr. I actually don't mind him, but he's not a comedian that like I would buy tickets for ever again to go see. I'll watch his specials and, you know, that's a whole thing. But like, you really also have to like you have to really go deeper into what it is that he's saying to really listen that it is a critique on that type of thing. Right. But there are people who just love it for face value and they're not willing to go to below the surface. Mm-hmm. And so then you have like, you know, like it was shortly after the Rittenhouse verdict and there were people who were like, yeah, we support him, blah, blah, blah. Like very, like the audience was like a very diverse mixture of people, black people, white people, all of that. But like there were people that were there. It was like, they had probably never, ever been to they had never been to a comedy show, never been to a place where there were other people that were not them. And they were just like, let's go watch Bill talk about how the liberals are fucking everything up. And I'm like, oh God. And I say that voice because that's how they talked. Not because I'm... Right.
This is representative of the people that were there that night.
Yes, exactly.
That you heard yourself.
Exactly.
I love that.
So I think it's some of those things. I like I do not suffer fools to live sometimes.
Right.
So I will live. I shushed a little girl at a musical before COVID. I shushed that girl because she was singing and she needed to know not to fucking sing.
Right.
At the musical.
Yeah.
Pay too much damn money for those seats.
Oh, that is always the worst when people are singing like at the top of their lungs and they're bad. And again, it's like, you're not going to, like the guy last night, the guy who sings, his name, he's related to Bear McCreary. It's Brendan McCreary. I think that's how you say it. But Bear McCreary does a lot of composing and stuff. I think he did that Lord of the Rings show, new one. Like he did that. He did The Walking Dead. Like he composes music for them. So Brendan, I think it's McCreary. I'm not too sure. I go to Oingo Boingo shows for Jeffrey. Jeffrey loves him some Mystic Nights of the Oingo Boingo. The Erngaberga, as I like to call them. I like Danny Elfman. I would prefer that we had gone to the Hollywood Bowl to see the Danny Elfman show instead, which I think is what we're going to do next year, because I think even Jeffrey is fed up, because this is the third time we've done this show. They do it usually every year in San Diego, the Saturday before Halloween. It's kind of tradition. Mm-hmm. This is the third time we've done it, and this is like the third time it's been like progressively worse. I'm like, next time we're all just going to come naked and just fucking fight each other to the death while Oingo Boingo, you know, plays brass instruments over it. Yeah, exactly. And screams about dead people and body parts. It'll be perfect, actually. I'm here for this. We'll film it. We'll get some drones, you know, over it. It'll be awesome.
Yes, all dressed up with nowhere to go. Full on gladiator. Stark naked. It'll be exactly. The ending of Hereditary.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what I do want to say is, like, Oingo Boingo has a very broad fan base, and the people that were misbehaving behind us all night were queer people. It just wasted, though.
We can be assholes, too.
Right, exactly. So I just...
White people?
I don't consider it necessarily...
White people?
Two of them were white.
Okay.
Yeah, which is, again, I think why security didn't kick them out, because when they came up to break up the fight, they made an assumption that the black guy that was with them was the one who was involved in the fight. And I will say it's because they were all drunk and kept pointing at each other. But he was not involved. But security got a little bit in his face. And I do think that kind of, because that guy, he started getting really loud about, like, why do you think it was me? Why are you blaming me? But again, they were all, it's him. You know, I mean, they were wasted. I mean, the one guy, he kept getting in front of us and, like, turning around, and his mouth was, like, hanging slack-jawed, and his eyes were all glazed over, and he's holding a beer in his hand, you know, and he's wavering all over the place.
You just look like a zombie. Just
yeah,
now.
That's like, what he looked like. Yeah, yeah. And they were dressed as skeletons, and they had face paint and stuff. I mean, but there was a mess. I mean, the makeup was smeared everywhere. It was a goddamn nightmare. But the point is like...
Not only were they trash, their makeup was terrible.
Yeah, well, it's really funny. Before we even got there, so before we got into the venue, and this is my fault, I think, you know, again, well, it's not my fault, because it's not my will, it's as I foresaw it.
Okay, Cassandra?
Yes.
Okay, Cassandra?
So, that's still one of my favorite quotes. I know I say that on here a lot, but I'm just saying, I did not want the night to go this way, but I did know it would.
Because... No, hold on, I have never... heard you say this quote before.
Yeah, I've quoted it on
no,
here.
No, you have not.
Oh, well, then I definitely use it in my life quite often when I'm like, this is not what I want. It's just what I see.
What is this from?
Well, I pulled it from Scream 2. Nev Campbell's character is playing Cassandra in...
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah.
And she gives a whole speech. So that's how I know it, how I know that quote of, you know, it's not by my hand or will, but as I foresaw it. So we were standing in line. You know, we got there. There were the three women in front of us who ended up being the three women who were sitting on the wall right in front of us. So because they knew the secret to Humphreys. They're like, oh, yeah, we get here early to sit on the wall. It's like, us too. Yay, let's be besties. They're very sweet. The one woman, I heard her talking to Jeffrey. She's like, who does his makeup? And Jeffrey's like, he does his makeup. And I turn around. She's like, you do your makeup? I was like, yeah, I do my makeup myself. She's like, wow. She was like, somehow,
wow,
you know.
They thought you were rich.
Flabbergasted by the fact that
you hired someone to do that.
And it was just red eyeshadow and some silver. You know, it was like one of my typical looks. Yeah. So it was just really funny. But she was just like mystified by the fact that I do my own makeup.
Yes.
Anyways, not the point. But we were standing in line, and they had all of the elite security there, as always. They're like, it's time for our meeting, you know.
The worst name for that whole merry band.
Well, especially that night, because they definitely did not help at all with all the fights and all the like drunken craziness that was going on. But anyways, they all like were huddling, and they went off together. And so jokingly, as they were like walking by, I was like, oh yes, like you got to prepare the new ones. To let them know that the Oingo Boingo crowd, it's going to be a bunch of weirdo queers, you know, some lovely ladies out for, you know, a fun little night, and a bunch of drunk, straight douchebag bros, and it's going to be a nightmare. That's your meeting adjourned. And the woman in front of us, the one who asked about my makeup later, was like, is that really what it's like? I'm like, well, the last couple times we've come, it's gotten a little out of control at times with the bros bouncing up and down with their beers. But this time it was the queers. Like that, I just rhymed that. This time it was the queers causing all the
beers
chaos.
And queers.
Because even the old dudes that I was really worried about, because they were gross. I mean, fuck all of them for the way they were talking and behaving. But they were pretty well behaved. It's not like they were wasted jumping up and down being jerks. Well, in fact, they were also struggling with these guys who kept bumping into them. And like, it was like three people that caused so much havoc, and the woman that brought the chocolate psilocybins, who also, they were like, you should join us. I'm like, oh, great. So all four of you can talk through the whole goddamn show, which is what happened.
It's not what I wanted, but it was as I foresaw.
Yeah. And poor, I felt bad for the Sam Squinch because he really, really loves Oingo Boingo. He does. He just, he's loved them for, you know, whatever, 40 years that they've, that the band has existed in all its different incarnations.
Sometimes fans fucking suck.
Yeah. And we were, he's just like, yeah, I don't know if I can keep doing it. He's like, cause I couldn't even focus on the songs. Like, cause they, it was just all night long. Cause I really thought that by the time Oingo Boingo took the stage, they'd at least focus on him, on them, on, you know, but by that time they were just too wasted. Did I make my point about Brendan McCreary? Oh, my whole point about that was that he's a fantastic singer. He sounds a lot like Danny Elfman. Like, they picked a really good guy for it. He can go really deep and really high. You know, I mean, he's just like, his range is insane. And I'm just like, you drunkenly singing, screaming over him, like, just stop. Like, you know, you're never going to sound as good. Or people at the Jesse Ware concert, like, you know, just
what's
like,
your vision?
Just like, ah, stop it. Just
I did not come here. I did not pay to hear you.
Yeah,
I did not pay this Munties to hear you, Hunty. Yeah.
So I just really, at the end of the night, I just kind of felt bad for Jeffrey because it really ruined his experience. Because he stood in front of me, so I was kind of a buffer between. Yeah. But it was still like,
did you ever felt yourself like physically called to be violent? Like, were you close?
No, but I mean, I definitely know how to close ranks. You know what I mean? And I was really upset with the guys next to us because I'm like, y'all, you know, form the barrier. Do not let this little fucker keep bouncing up and back and forth and doing all this nonsense. Just don't let him get in front of you.
Yeah.
And they just wouldn't do it. You know, whereas I was like, nope. You know, like, you are not stepping in front of me again. You know, and anytime they push into me, I would kind of just like shove them back. So, but not like violent. Like, I'm not going to punch someone. Yeah. I'm not going to do all of that, you know. But I will be a little passive aggressive and talk nastily. Yeah. So, yeah, I definitely called them assholes a few times and told them to shut the fuck up a few times. But again, they were too wasted to care. And they'd already had all their energy sapped from the first fight they had, so they weren't going to fight me. And then, like I said, the one, eventually, he kind of sat down. He was like, Baba, and he fell over backwards, over the wall, and into the dirt. And I'm like, he's just going to roll down the hill into the bay. And security had to go. And by that time, I was like, yeah, I'm like officially done with this. I will watch the rest of the show from the back. There was only like four or five songs left, so I just went to the back and like hung out and waited for Jeffrey. But he came out, even I think two songs before, and he was just like, I can't anymore. It's so bad over there. And yeah, and it was so funny because they're just like, everybody just looked, like I said, harried. Like, everybody just can't believe we get paid to do this, like, deal with all this mess.
No, we're not getting paid enough.
But the band sounded great. They always do. I told Jeffrey, I was like, next time we should just like rent a room at Humphrey's and like, you know, that way we could just sit on the balcony and watch a show. You know, just fuck it. Like, let's not even do the crowd. We'll just be, because it's really cool. Have you been to Humphrey's, right?
I've never been to Humphrey's.
Oh, man, we have to go sometime because it's a really cool, beautiful venue. That's the other thing. It's so tranquil. Like, you know, you have the night sky and like you're right there on the bay, like Shelter Island, you know, mm-hmm. So it's really beautiful. People bring their boats up and they, you know, and their little
San Diego Bay is very calm. It's not like San Francisco Bay. So,
it's gorgeous. And it's a gorgeous venue with beautiful, you know, they did it up recently and added these really neat lights, you know, that hang above your heads. It's such a nice atmosphere. You know, you just get like a glass of wine and like enjoy the show. Like when I saw Sarah McLachlan there, it was like just so peaceful. Hell, even like seeing Garbage and the Mavericks and other people that I've seen there, which are more upbeat shows, nobody behaved exactly this way.
No.
This is just was like,
it sounds like it's cis white masculinity.
Yeah, whether it's queer or straight or whatever. Because this time it was just the gays were just being really, really bad. And I know we feel like we deserve to because it's Halloween and it's like our day.
That's we munch butts and we celebrate Halloween.
There we go. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back.
Joshua needs to calm down
about more existential horror in Hellraiser.
Meanwhile, in New Jersey...
So, Marissa, what talking points do you want to hit on in this week's episode?
Well, Jackie, let's talk about how the film addresses the patriarchy. Ooh, and representation of marginalized people. Ooh, ooh, and even philosophical ramifications of good versus evil in horror.
We can point out the triangle boobs, talk about the blood splatter, and, the practical effects. And also the male gaze?
My gaze at the males.
Hi-o!
From feminism to fangirling, the Jersey Ghouls cover all the bases of horror from a woman's perspective.
New episodes are uploaded every other Sunday.
Just search Jersey Ghouls to find us on social media and your favorite podcasting app.
Welcome back. So, today is kind of exciting because of all the films that I've thought about showing you and discussing, Hellraiser's been one that you have actively put off, that you've been like, not yet, not yet, not yet. And I was finally like, listen, little Josephine, my dear, dear love, they are rebooting Hellraiser, and I cannot have you out in these streets not knowing the OG. Mm-hmm. I just can't have it. I can't have it. And we were having a movie night, and I knew you would be there to watch the Hellraiser reboot, so we had to watch Hellraiser 1987, written and directed by Clive Barker from his own novella, The Hellbound Heart. We present Hellraiser, the story of a puzzle box that can bring untold majesties into your life. Such sights. Joe, what did you think of the sights of Hellraiser 1987? We're going to talk a little bit about the reboot, but this mostly is about this Hellraiser. And then we'll watch a few more, and maybe we'll revisit the reboot in the future. Yeah. So we're mostly going to focus today on the 87 film. So, what'd you think?
First of all, this is not technically new November.
No, it's exactly. Like, but we're inspired by something that came out in 2022.
So the spirit is there.
Yes. I finally got you to watch it. That's what's new and wonderful. You've evolved.
I've evolved. I did not think it was as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Which I kept saying. Yeah. I told you.
Not as bad as what I thought it was going to be. I feel like if it was a first season Fright School thing, it might have been a lot. Mm-hmm. Might have been, but like now, you know, you made me watch an abortion and dumplings. Like, it's, you know, inside.
A very important abortion.
Yes.
It's a salient abortion.
Yes, exactly. Shout, hashtag shout your abortion.
Yes.
And eat it, apparently.
It's good for your skin.
Yes. It was good. I will not watch it again. Do not make
you.
Me. do not make me. I will not watch it again. It was also like... It was interesting to watch. Practical effects. It reminded me a lot of Nightbreed, which I know is also Clive Barker.
Yeah.
In fact, you showed me Nightbreed before you showed me anything else.
Well, Nightbreed, even that was before we even started Fright School at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
well, at least in the, you know, the official sense of Fright School.
Yes. And yeah, it was interesting. It was like I can see. I like the idea of like the ideas of like pain and pleasure. I wanted more of the Cenobites, and I think that that's what happens in the future in the sequels, right? You get a little bit more of them.
To some degree. Yeah.
I wanted more of the Cenobites. I thought that like it was just kind of this weird, odd, haunted house kind of thing with like the woman bringing everybody back and all that
with Julia bringing them in back to help, reconstitute Frank,
reconstitute Uncle Frank, and it was good. It was not as bad as I thought. I won't watch it again though because I was still. There were things that were a little puzzling, and I think that just might be
puzzling.
Get it? But yeah, it was good.
What were you puzzled by?
I wanted there to be, because like the thing about Hellraiser and the reason why, I should start there. The reason why I did not want to watch Hellraiser for so long is because when I was a kid, maybe I've told this story on Fright School, maybe not, but when I was a kid, there was a poster. There was a poster in a video store in a strip mall that my a little strip mall shopping arcade that was across from where I got my haircut every as a child, and it was like there the entire like the entirety of my childhood. These two posters were there. And we went in the strip mall. We went, like, my dad would go get.
Was this in City Heights?
No, this was on Guam.
This was on Guam.
So we were on Guam. My dad would also get his haircut at the same time, kill two birds with one stone. He liked to go before, he was like, wanted to be the first appointment of the day.
Oh, okay.
Like,
smart, actually.
Yeah, he never wanted, I always try to get
the first appointment for my hair as well.
I didn't, like, for a long time, I didn't know that you could get your hair cut at any other time than like 7 a.m. on a Saturday.
That's delightful.
So he would go and he would just take me. And every time, and even if he didn't get a haircut that time, he always, 7 a.m. on a Saturday, wake me the fuck up. We would go. Sometimes we would go. There was like a diner that had donuts that like I've only been to, like I only went to a couple times. But the big thing would be like, you know, we would come back. It would still be early. We would come back and like we'd bring like McDonald's breakfast for everybody. So,
oh, nice.
That was a very rare occasion, but yeah, it was nice and nice and fun. Anyway, nothing in the strip mall was open. Like for a while, I was thinking about it now, and I'm like, how is this a reliable business model that like the only thing open in this indoor mall arcade was this salon? Nothing else was open. And I remember because, like, when he would get his haircut, I would wander around. So, like, I would see, like, a Korean restaurant. I would see all these other businesses. The diner would be open, of course. But no one was ever, the video store was never open. And it had, like, clear walls. You could see all the movies and stuff. But he had two posters hanging right outside of the video place. The first poster was The 13th Warrior, starring Antonio Banderas, which is based on the Michael Crichton novel. It's about, like, you know, this, like, Arab, Spaniard, something like Moor, I think he is. He's, like, with the Vikings. It's about the Vikings. And then you had the other poster was Hellraiser. And it was Pinhead with the box, and it was like this really tight shot of his face, like, you know, grinning with his teeth, and then the pins coming up. And I remember looking at that as a kid and being fucking terrified every single time. I would forget it was there and turn my back and like, oh my God, it's fucking Hellraiser. So I do not have good associations or feelings with that until now. Was everything I want on the other side of fear? No, I didn't know what it is that I wanted. But I made it through and it was fine. But that is why we have delayed this for so long.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you for being here to work through my childhood trauma.
I love it. Yeah, that's what I'm
put all that
about.
In your thesis.
Yeah, I will. you know, I wonder if there's a way I can like swing that. Like, I have been helping someone for 6 years.
Yes.
Deep psychoanalytic work on their fear and their anxiety, and we finally had a breakthrough with 1987's Hellraiser.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I don't know what. I don't remember the first time I saw this movie. It's one of those things that just always existed for me, like Freddy Krueger, like everything else. I remember as I got older, they would do, once the first three movies were out, Hellraiser, Hellraiser 2, I think it's Hellbound, and then...
Is your novel here?
Hellraiser 3 is, Hell on Earth. Hold on. It's up here.
Hold on. I'm making Joshua reach for a book in the library.
The Hellbound Heart. That's the original book, which I didn't read till many years later because I didn't know who Clive Barker was as a kid, you know. I remember finding out, like, Candyman, that he wrote the original story of that and all. So that's kind
of
how I got...
That's in the Books of Blood, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's how I got introduced. Or is that in the Books of Blood or is it in... it might be in the Inhuman... Condition. I've got all my Clive Barker books right here. We can just grab them because it's called.
For those who think that the Wes Craven Memorial Library is an imaginary space, it actually is a real space that has actual books in it.
Yeah. The Forbidden. So it's part of In the Flesh. Well, it re-released under In the Flesh. It might have been part of the original six books of blood or something. I don't remember. But that's what I have it collected in is in a re-release with like four or five other novellas. So yeah, I don't really remember, but once all of the first three films were out, they would do like trilogy, like showings of them on television. Mm-hmm. So I have really distinct memories in like the early 90s of like hanging out in my mom's bedroom. She had a TV in there and we would all like crawl into bed and watch the three Hellraiser movies together.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, and I just thought they were wild. Like, and I still feel the same way. Like, I just, like, it's such like a bizarre, subversive kind of thing. Yeah. It's just, it's hard not to look, it's hard to look away, you know, when you're, oh, here, I'll take that back.
I actually, can I read it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You could borrow it. Yeah, for certain. But I was just going to, there might be some things to reference out of it.
Yeah.
As the conversation continues.
Oh my God, is this me being accountable that I will read The Hellbound Heart?
Yes, you should. Again, look how quick it is. It's only 100 and something pages. It's 160 pages.
I've read porn longer. It's
there you go. 164 pages, Joe. You should be able to power through that. Yeah.
I actually do have I'm going on a business trip soon. I'm going for out of town for work. So maybe I'll read it on the plane and then see
What it unlocks.
Yeah, what it opens.
There you go. So there's this idea that in the 80s, there was a sort of movement of like splatterpunk, like super gory kind of stuff that Clive Barker falls into, which you'll see some of my nicknames.
I was going to say, is that where that comes from?
Yeah, yeah. I use it from that for that, splatterpunk. Because I just love that. That's such a great term, splatterpunk. So I've used it for years and years as screen names whenever I can, sometimes with my birth date or, you know, whatever, because different places, you know, different things people already are using
splatterpunk it. Splatterpunk 55.
Exactly. Yes. Splatterpunk 55. You just like threw me off what I was going to say. Anyway, so in trying to do some research for this, I was actually really shocked. You know, I have all these books and like, they rarely, if at all, mention the Hellraiser series, which is so interesting to me because there's so much that can be unpacked in this, you know, especially when you contextualize, like, this original novel came out, let me see, 19-something, we do know that, 86, and then adapted to film by Clive himself and directed by Clive himself into the 1987 film. So, you know, the AIDS crisis is going on. You're having more and more, like, we're kind of in this shift, like, with sexuality, obviously, within popular music, popular content. It's before kind of S&M became, like, what it is now. You know, like, everybody uses S&M in their imagery. Yeah. It's so, like, benign now to see, like, you know, somebody like Taylor Swift in a leather outfit, you know, which is, like, I think echoes this kind of sadomasochistic kind of thing. Doesn't Rihanna have a whole song about this or something?
S&M, but that's about the press.
Oh, okay. But still, but using that kind of imagery. Yeah. Obviously, Madonna, very famously, in Erotica and her sex book, that was lots of S&M, BDSM, sorts of imagery.
Because it's playing on, quote-unquote, subversive.
Yeah, and especially this time felt really subversive. Like, what can you do? Like, you're setting this story in like a fairly benign house with a family, it feels very like suburban, quote unquote normative. Obviously, you know, the relationships at play are anything but. There's a lot of, you know, subversive things happening, but just sort of introduced to like horror audiences these like creatures who are, you know, the Cenobites, who are horrifically mutilated and scarred, and then they're wrapped in like S&M, like chains and black leather. It just feels really, really, really super subversive. And so in trying to do some research, like I said, I found very little, which kind of shocks me, the amount of analysis that's not available on Hellraiser, at least in the books that we do have. But Monsters in the Closet, Homosexuality in the Horror Film by Ben Schaff does have a few things from Clive Barker. And I like this. It's like Barker's work may be understood by some as once again demonizing homo, in quotes, sexuality by linking it to the monstrous. Yet Barker defends this practice by dramatizing the seductive, universalizing nature of the monster queer in the first place. So he says, horror fiction tends to be reactionary. This is a quote from Clive Barker. It's usually about a return to the status quo. The monster is the outsider who must be banished from the sanctum. But over and over again, I've created monsters who come from the outside and who call out to somebody to join them in the sanctum. And then he also says he's adamant about rewriting the genre to focus on the potential to dramatize and evoke social psychological change. Horror movies should not have happy endings. Again, this is a quote, not in the classic sense. Hero and heroine should not walk hand in hand into the sunset. It's important that people be transformed in the action of the story. They may be transformed by a very fundamental way. They may begin alive and end up dead. They may lose limbs. They may lose their sanity. Within the context of my fiction, I think such changes are upbeat. I love Clive Barker. So delightful. Anyway, so I bring that up because I do think there's some critique that we could kind of start with about Hellraiser. So if you're going to use elements of a sexuality and of a performance of that sexuality, so whether it is the dominant submissive play that's inherent in S&M, you know, or sadomasochism, the blurring the lines of pleasure and pain, which again, we can discuss like that in the very real, like corporeal sense of like, for most people, like anal sex, for instance, does not start out as like super fun. You know, it's something that like you have to push past the pain to get to the pleasure of it.
Yeah.
So you're taking this idea of the limits of pleasure and pain and kind of blending them together, which is something that's kind of inherent in a certain type of queer sexuality. Mm-hmm. And again, I do mean queer in the sense not only of like homosexual relationships, but just queer in like not what society typically thinks of as normal, including like S&M. We see that as kind of a subversive thing. Or we did, at least. Again, nowadays it's become much more normalized, and elements of it, you know, can be part of anybody's like sexuality, like spanking or, you know, some of the more, you know, benign elements. But you're kind of anyways, the point is saying that Clive Barker, as a queer person, using elements of queer sexuality, of underground sexuality, and turning them into these monsters could play to a certain type of like, conservative, I guess I'll say, instead of using the R word, but a certain conservative idea of what queer people are or what, you know. So, of course, you have this family who are being attacked by these, you know, monstrous embodiments of the queer, you know, tearing them apart. But in Hellraiser, whose fault is it that these monsters are in their lives? It's fucking Frank's hedonism and his, like, pursuit of male sexual desires for women, you know, and for that. So it's like, it's his monstrous sexuality that is in the pursuit of the Cenobites and is what brings them into their lives. And, you know, we could say that he like corrupts Julia, or maybe she was corrupt already. This is stuff we can further explore when we watch the sequel, mm-hmm. where she's a very prominent, role. You know, so it's like, it's just very interesting. It's like, you know, who is inviting who into the room? Mm-hmm. Into the bedroom, into wherever, you know. So I just think there's some interesting things that we can talk about. But I am curious, for you watching it for the first time, you know, does any of this sort of resonate with you? Do you feel any, like, anti-queer sentiment for it?
Anti-queer? No.
Okay.
I mean, also, probably my notions about that are all affected by the fact that I know that it was written and directed by Clive Barker based on his story, and he is a queer person. So, you know, for whatever, you know, knowing...
And we've seen a lot more normalization, probably, of...
Yeah. And so it's just like, okay, well, he is here to, like, he is steering the ship in this way, and so inherently, the entire film, it's, you know, from start to finish, is queer. It's in queer horror, not only because... content aside, it's like, you know, he was at... it was his hand that...
And I'm pretty sure...
It was Clive his was will out. And intention.
Exactly. I'm pretty sure he was out. Like, I think that Clive has kind of always been known to be gay or queer, you know, which was something that, like, yeah, I was really excited by when I discovered, and then like finding out he wrote Candyman and Hellraiser and all that. You know, then I went out and I got like a bunch of his books. I've got a ton of them. This is such a beautiful writer. But anyway, sorry, continue.
No, but that's it. So I don't think there's any anti-queer sentiment. I think it's interesting because, like, you know, if anything, what it kind of brought to me was like these people who are dabbling in alternative, quote unquote, expressions of pleasure, which, you know, at the time, an alternative expression of pleasure would have been like what, anal sex, right? Like, it's that they, you know, without respecting that or fully understanding it, they are, you know, cut off. They meet a requisite end and receive some sort of recompense for that.
Right.
In the way that, like, you know, people who don't understand queerness and, you know, maybe it's more commenting on the mainstreaming of queerness and the subsequent recompense and, you know, misunderstanding of, like, cis, straight people have about it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting take. So, like, sort of like the puzzle box and the seeking of ultimate pleasures. Yeah, what does that mean? And
exactly,
what do you unlock?
And also, like, let's
within
think
of ourselves
and think about it. Right? It's just like, you know, we as queer people, our lives are enriched because of that. Like,
right,
you know, if we struggles and, you know, homophobia notwithstanding, our lives are very rich and very fulfilling because of our queerness and because of who we are and all of that. And these folks, you know, they live like they're living these lives that are bound by their idea of what pleasure is or their idea of, you know, the boxes in which they live, and pursuing the box, pursuing these ultimate pleasures is a way to kind of break out of that.
Right.
When in actuality, it's just like, well, no, like, yeah, you're still even limited by that because of you're still limited by who it is that you sleep with. Whereas if you had no limits on pleasure, you probably would have a more fulfilling life.
Yeah. I mean, certainly it is to wonder at like Frank's, like, what has he done so far? In the book, it's, you know, it's very, very, like, I think that's sort of an interesting thing, is, like, a queer person to write this, like, straight male character whose idea of, like, so he, you know, and they talk about it in the book, like, that I, you know, he thinks opening the box is going to bring, like, all of these, like, quivering, oiled, like, women to him. And that, like, the ultimate pleasure is, like, this, like, harem of like, endless buffet of women. Yeah. And that they would help him have the ultimate, like, erotic sort of experiences. But, you know, as they say, like, we are explorers in the further regions of experience. And so we bring something completely different than what you expect by our definition of what is pleasure.
And let's get right into it, right? So, like, you know, if he is a, you know, a heterosexual man who thinks that he is going to experience the full reach of, like, erotic pleasure for a man to experience, we know very intimately that pleasure comes from, you know, anal sex stimulation of the prostate. Part of that, you know, part of that, like, you know what I'm saying? Like the male G spot is, I'm trying to make a reference of, like, you know, the him as cis male, like, you know, he thinks that, like, if he's going to experience this, like, you know, women sucking on him and, fucking all these women, it's like, oh, but if he wants, like, the truest male's pleasure, you know, full body orgasm, he essentially could also receive a little bit of pain by putting something up his butt and, you know, stimulating the prostate. Is that what it is? Are the Cenobites basically anal sex? It's just like,
is that what they represent in the end?
Is that what they represent, like, in the end? Haha. In the, you know what I'm like making gestures. It's like, you know,
you are making gestures.
Like, going in there and, like, you know, pushing past the pain.
You're going to go in. There's a Shell station on the left.
Yes, exactly. The furthest reaches of experience. Find this, like, little walnut and, you know, start pushing at it.
Yeah, that's exactly what Clive wrote this book for, so he could pick up more straight guys. I definitely think this is a manual.
That's not what I'm saying.
For flipping them. No.
You know what I mean. You
but yeah, I mean, I get that. It's like questioning, like, what?
It's a very crude thing to say. It's not the most enlightened.
But when you decide, when you have boundaries, then what is beyond the boundaries? Again, this is playing with the ideas of, like, obviously the punishment of that, and or at least it's unexpected, and you discover what you like really really wanted is not at all what you wanted.
Yeah.
So obviously there's some questions and some stuff in there, and I think that's really interesting to consider. Again, we have to also remember Clive Barker is British, and so he's like dealing with, at this time, like, I think Margaret Thatcher was the prime minister, and so there's a whole like very anti-gay sentiment. So there's all this fear of what you don't know. But again, of course, in his novel, like, there's very good reason to be afraid of the Cenobites, and very good reason to be afraid of the other. But yeah, which is why, again, it makes it kind of messy in analyzing it. Like, I think there's some really cool stuff to think about. And so I found this that I think is, it's kind of interesting to just, again, to think about. So Barker's equation of eroticism and blood is particularly powerful for a film released at the height of the AIDS crisis, and it could be taken as either a transgression of all sexual mores in a time of increasing homophobia and puritanism, or a moralizing commentary on the dangers of sexual licentiousness. Licentiousness. I love that word. Even though Kirstie can be read as a representation of sexual purity, and therefore she, of course, lives at the end, it's hard to deny that Hellraiser's appeal lies not in the vanquishing of sadomasochistic erotic temptations, but in its possibility. In many ways, Pinhead, who promises emotional and erogenous release at the same time that he guarantees eternal torment, he's kind of an incarnation of like a Victorian dandy Dracula. The Hellraiser series would continue with blah, blah, blah. We don't care about this. It's a strange form of reverse wish fulfillment. We want the repressed to keep returning, providing us yet another opportunity to push past our earthbound limits, which I think that's really interesting. When like something is... this kind of plays, I guess, maybe into the psychology of like sexuality in general. It's like when something's okay to do, maybe suddenly we're not as interested in it, you know?
Yeah.
Like there was a time, like, again, I admit to a certain level of like histrionics, like especially in high school, of like being out and being queer and, you know, kind of like letting other students kind of know that I like, you know, I'm sexually active with other men. There was like a weird thing. It's like a weird, like,
there's a power there.
There's it's like a subversive kind of thing. But as that's normalized, it's just kind of like, well, who cares who sleeps with? Which again, I agree with. Like, I want to get us to that point where we just don't care at all about any of these kinds of things. But this idea of repression as being like sexually like erotic, you know, or like what you can't have is like the ultimate, you know, kind of thing. Because that's at play the relationship with like Frank and Julia. Because it's like, oh, he's her husband's brother, and it's so like. It's like their wedding night or before the wedding, and they're like sleeping together with him, even though it's like, this is a terrible dude, girl. Like, get away from him, you know? But that's not the point. The point, it's like in the taboo-ness of it.
Yeah. Very quick side tangent. You talked about, like, you know, when you're in high school, the histrionic aspect of being like openly sexual or, you know, so there was a kid when I was a freshman in high school in Guam, there was a kid who may be trans now thinking about it, but like they were definitely a boy, but like had like full beat on, like hair. But like dressed like a boy. And I remember talking with them, and like I was just fascinated by them, but I was also kept my distance because, again, you know, me not wanting to be found out or be called my straightness at my straight presentation calling into question at the time. And like he would talk about how, like, yeah, you know, like, you know, he would be like, this is kind of gross. He's like, when you like take a shit, and however big the shit is, that's how big the dick is that you can take. Trust me, I know. And he would say like these things to like kids.
Oh my God.
But like, you know, from a gross out factor or whatever, right. You know, like he was doing these things to make the other straight guys uncomfortable because they would bully him, call him queer, call him fag. And he would be like, don't be, he would look, similar, I think, to experiences that maybe you're familiar with is that, you know, oh, yeah, it was like, don't flatter yourself, sweetie. Like, I won't. You know, I don't want you.
Oh, yeah. To some degree. I mean, I would never say something so foul.
No, that notwithstanding, but that's also part of it. Is right. Like that, yeah.
Yeah. No, there is like a histrionic kind of thing there.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Sorry. I'm still getting over that comment. oh, man. I love this. Highly suggestive phallic image, one of the monsters, an eyeless fiend whose gruesome makeup design stretches its lips to eternity so that all that's left on its face is a set of horribly chattering teeth, all appetite. The most loquacious of them, the one now known as Pinhead, his torn, bloody nipples peeking through his leather daddy outfit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, wow, this is, I like this article. It's called Queer and Now and Then. Queer and Now and Then, 1987, Hellraisers by Michael Koreski, published this in 2019.
Nice.
So yeah, just discussing, you know, all sort of these like queer. Let's see, what does this say? An auteur of literally gut-wrenching cinema, the British horror and fantasy author, Barker, and sometime movie director, might not seem to check the boxes for our preferred standards of gay positivity, but shred through the pulp and gore and you'll find the beating heart of a true queer auteur. I was trying to see where this was going. Oh, yeah. Film couples the sadomasochism with a heavy dose of homoeroticism, makes the film more singular, an unapologetic, impolite violation of heteronormative standards smuggled into a wide-release genre framework. Which, I mean, that's very true to some degree. I mean, this is a mainstream, like, horror film what did it make on its, well, $14.6 million. But, I mean, I don't know. In 1987, that might have been a really good... what did they think? Well, this is another film that I think gets a lot of contemporary, like, look back, you know, and yeah. given more props than it maybe deserves. Says it has a 70% on Rotten Tomatoes. Yeah.
Interesting.
Hellraiser placed it number 80 on the top 100 list of Time Out's top horror films from horror authors, directors, actors, and critics. That's interesting. I do think it's very singular in the idea of like what it presents, the imagery of it, the visuals. I mean, that's something that I don't think, I mean, it probably did exist somewhere else, but Hellraiser just really embodies all of those ideas in a really interesting way. And I just, yeah, I've always found it to be a very erotic series, despite like the gore of it all and like the questions at its center of like, what are we looking for? What is the ultimate pleasure? You know, especially for people who are like, which I'm proudly a hedonist, like, you know, yes, I want to have as much good times as possible before I am dust again. You know, that's what I'm here for. That's what we're all here for, is my personal opinion. So it's like, as long as we're not harming other people and, you know, again, not harming like ourselves, you know, eat the fruit from the tree. You know, do it. Enjoy yourself. No regrets. I was trying to think what my other point was. I've forgotten it. Damn it.
Is this like an appropriate time to move on to the remake?
Yeah, we might as well. Or the reboot, I guess they're calling it. Yeah, we can move on to that. So we watched that right after this. So that must have been a really interesting experience for you, because you got to see something like the original and its reboot for the first time, for both of them, like back to back. That must have been fascinating.
It was, because, like, I'm still concerned, even in watching the reboot, I'm like, is there anything that... It kind of like when we watched Prey, where it's like, is there anything that I'm not going to get because I haven't seen the other sequels?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the whole reason that you get a reboot like this is because it is it's a beloved IP that has a whole franchise, it has a whole, you know, lore about it.
Right.
Like, so what's that? Am I going to miss anything or not understand anything? And You did very well to be like, no, I think you're fine. I think ended up like,
yeah, it had everything that you needed to really know.
Yeah, and so I really,
it explained itself.
I enjoyed it from the aspect of like, it was what I thought. This is where we're like, this is what I thought the original was going to be. In the same way that like when we talked about the new. The new Texas Chainsaw Massacre on Netflix, like this is what people think that the original is,
right? With all the gore and the blood, and exactly. All that. Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And so in that way, I liked it. I also liked that it was. I liked what it was saying about like addiction. Like yeah. I really liked that aspect. I honed in on that a lot, and the idea and took kind of took it a different way with their final girl, in the sense that like she is also someone who is not a saint, like
right,
yeah, who's not pure in the same way that
not in that morality play purity that we usually think of. Yeah, no, she has a different kind of innocence.
I'm actually really curious to hear your thoughts because you know this is a beloved story. These from the novels and you know of Clive and everything. Like, and how do you, what I know that like when we had a little bit of conversation afterwards where it seemed like you were still a little muddled on it.
I just think it's always hard to like reboot something. I would have preferred to see sort of a new adaptation of the original source novel. I mean, obviously we can make those changes, and I do think it was important. Like, that's something that I'm not sure is really explored enough. Again, it's a novella, so it's shorter. But like, you know, Frank obviously has an addiction. You know, he has like sex addiction. He has like, you know, like hedonism in its furthest reaches can become addiction, you know, that ultimate pursuit of like escapism and getting away and looking for just to feel good all the time is like that's problematic, obviously.
Yes.
So I like the idea of exploring those sorts of things. I was just bothered by, like, for me personally, I just always felt like something I really liked is the idea that the Cenobites come out of desire and not by hands. So I was a little bothered by some of the people that were like opening the box and like suffering the consequences, even though they were doing it without knowing. Like, I think there's something really interesting and like delicious about that idea in the original novel, that like Frank is he doesn't know exactly what he's going to get, but he knows what the box does, that it does open a portal to something else, and he wants it. Mm-hmm. And they come and they give it to him. He finds out, yeah. You know? But so it's like I've always been kind of intrigued by that idea, and that's been something that's been said in like the films. You know, it's not hands that bring it; it's desire. You know, like so that kind of part of it, I was just like, oh man, they're like killing people left and right who really aren't involved in, you know, so they changed some of like the mythology.
Yeah.
But again, I can kind of separate, though, in thinking about it, I wish I would have watched it again before we did this because it's still not very fresh. And I do hope that we will revisit it in the future with a more full episode dedicated to it.
2 Januaries from now.
Exactly. When we do a whole thing on all the rest of the Hellraiser movies, put a pin in that. But overall, I liked it. I really enjoyed the look of the Cenobites. I thought they were much more true to like this idea of like using their own flesh to create their clothing. I thought was super interesting and even more like subversive than trying to, you know, if they would have tried to reinvent them with like leather and like whips and chains. I mean, I know the chains are still there, but it might have been hokey. It might have fell flat a little bit just because we're not as like bothered by that. Again, like you know, you can pop stars and, you know, with whips and chains are a dime a dozen these days, different from, you know, the 80s. So I really appreciated the design and the look of that. I also like the exploration of addiction and sort of the questions that kind of brings up. Overall, I really enjoyed it. I do hope that they continue. I would love to see another film from this same kind of team and explore even more, you know, what they, you know, ideas, maybe pull other things out of the work of Clive. I think it would be really cool.
Yeah.
He's got there's so much great material that hasn't even been adapted. So, you know, even outside of the Hellraiser universe, there's just so much. So it's like, if nothing else, I hope it brings a resurgence to his work and reading and, you know, all of that. But yeah, overall, the more I like sat with it, the more I'm like, you know, no, I did enjoy it. Like, again, it wasn't like I didn't like it right off the bat. It was just, I was kind of like, I don't know. It's kind of playing with some of the ideas that I think are really interesting, and it's kind of losing some of that, you know, with like the desire being at the base of like opening the box rather than just like idle curiosity about what it does or being tricked to open it by someone else. Cause again, that was in some of the other films where like, they trick somebody into opening it, but they still take the person who wanted the box opened. Mm-hmm. So, it's just something we're going to have to sit with out in culture and kind of see as it continues, like what it
and
will
see
mean.
What sequel comes from it. And I'm curious to see where they go with it.
Series
actually would be preferable because like, I mean, it would be cool if they did, like, it's two, but it's the story from Hellbound Heart, and you get Voight as Pinhead. Like, Voight is the new lead priest, Cenobite.
Yeah, or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be really, yeah. Yeah, there could be something really in there. And, like, there's some really cool stuff in Clive Barker in the sequel, in the book, The Scarlet Gospels, that they could also play with, where there's sort of like a, you know, warring factions of hell. So I think there's some intriguing things within, like, the Cenobites and the Cenobitic Order, you know, and the politics of it that could be really interesting to explore when we're looking at like our world's like religious politics.
Yeah.
You know, what does that look like in hell? What does that look like for this specific? Cause that's the idea, is that like the Cenobites in future films and properties and comics and all of that, you know, that they're sort of, they're this like monk like kind of
monastic order
of the Gash, you know, the Order of the Gash. And
what? It's the Order of the Gash?
Yeah, like a gash, you know, like a cut.
Oh, like, I thought you meant like, you know, like a gash, like you're, you know.
Yeah, no, I think they mean like quite literally a gash, the Order of the Gash. Okay. So they're their own like specific order in hell that's like operating, you know, sort of like on their own with this hell priest or hell priestess now, or whoever is embodying
hell
that.
Priest X.
Right. There we go. I love that. Hell priest X. So it's just, I think there's a lot more to explore, and I hope that they do. I do really love the Hellraiser series. Some of the movies are really, really bad. Of course, you're always going to have that when you have a million films. But I definitely think the first two are really good. I also love how, like, what's it called? Bloodline, the fourth one, where they're, like, in space for a minute. It's fucking weird.
What?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
What? Yeah, Pinhead in space. Anyways.
Because when you don't know what to do anymore.
Yeah. It does both, because it goes way back in time, too, and explains, like, the creation of the box, and then brings it kind of to the future and to the present, and moves around. But we get a really cool design in Angelique, one of the Cenobites. She's really cool looking. But anyways. I guess that's Hellraiser for now. Now that we've opened the box and we came, we can continue to explore the further regions of the Hellraiser universe. Finally, it is open.
Have you turned me into a Cenobite?
I don't know. Have I? What kind of Cenobite would you be, you think?
Oh, probably something with my belly.
Oh, yeah. I think there's like scenes. I don't know. Is it in the first movie or is it in later ones? But there's ones where one of the Cenobites is called Butterball.
Yeah, he looks like a dick, right? Is that the one?
The other one was the Chatterer with the teeth. That's when I think they were calling phallic. But like Butterball, like I think he pulls things like out of his stomach and eats them again.
Mm.
Yeah, it's super.
I'd be Butterball.
Delicious. I really like the design on like Angelique that you see in the fourth movie, because her like scalp is like opened and pulled back, and then it's like
pinned
to her shoulders. It just makes it really, and her like abs are like splayed open. Mm. She's just really a beautiful design, I think. Even, you know, Hellraiser Bloodline is, again, its own journey, we'll say. There's a lot of those in the Hellraiser universe, just its own thing. But she's a really cool design as well. I'm trying to think who, like, there's some... There's some real weird Cenobites out there. The CD guy, Justice for CD Cenobite, who's just got a bunch of CDs jammed in his body. Justice for him. I posted about that on one of our friends' walls because we were talking about, like, quote unquote, the dumbest Cenobites. Like, leave CD Cenobite alone. Leave her alone. yeah, there we go. Super fun. Yay, Hellraiser.
Yay.
Gay as fuck.
Yeah.
Gory, weird, ooey gooey. A lot of goo.
Ooey gooey, extra chewy.
Yes, yes, yes. Help me. I'm in hell. No, I mean it. That's a cry for help.
Is that what you said at the Oingo Boingo concert? Help me. I'm in hell. See, look, here, let's loop it all back, right?
Round.
You went to this concert in search of, you know, sonic pleasure, and you were met with the furthest reaches of that pleasure, which was, and in the truest sense, you know, in, you know, Sartre, you know, truest sense of hell is as other people. So.
Yes, absolutely.
Bring it all back.
Bring it all back, Joe. That was beautiful. Mm. You'd be a good therapist, just wrapping it all up at the end. Look at that tight little bow.
And our time is up now.
And our time is up now. All right. Good night.
Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davey Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.